A mother's gift to her country's cause is a story yet untold. She had two sons, the only ones each worth his weight in gold. She gave them up for the sake of war while her heart was rent with pain. As each went away, she was heard to say, "He will never return again." One lies down in Appomattox, many miles away. The other sleeps at Chickamauga, and they both wore suits of gray. To the tune of Down and Dixie, the third was laid away. In the trench of Santiago, the blue and the gray. She's alone tonight while the stars shine bright with a heart full of pain. At the last gray day, she was heard to say, "When I go up there, my three boys will be there. Perhaps they'll stand at the heavenly gate on guard beside their guns. So the mother, true to the gray and blue, may enter with her sons."
When is that song? It's obviously a Civil War song, but when was that popular?
That was popular during the Spanish-American War. He should bring you down to that. It's in the trench of Santiago.
Mm-hmm.
It's in, we were fighting in Cuba. Horrifying. It's nothing but organized murder.
Mm-hmm.
And then look what they use now, national security. Everything in the... And then think of CBS giving a corrupt man like Haldane $25,000 for an interview.
I was just furious at that.
Well, and look at Agnew now publishing a novel. The Lady Kim Jr. had an article by him just before that, you know. He got a retainer on that. And his interview was so absolutely obscene. For instance, he never thought of that, but he would think that anyone came with those alchemist clothes, and there's nothing underneath that. It's so sick, it's sickeningly, it's not really sick. It's just sickeningly sly obscenity.
There, in an interview before, you had mentioned a trial with longshoremen that Francis's husband was involved in.
Yeah, Brick Webster.
Could you explain more? Was that before the Smith Act cases?
I think 42 years, I think it was.
Oh, it was during the war?
Well, you know, it's strange, you know, that I don't remember that about the war being at that time, but it might have been. But Dick Webster, there were five of them who were accused of murder in the longshoreman strike. Actually, a guy by the name of North, who was a very reactionary guy, was responsible. They themselves did the shooting, and this trial took place at Judge Ambrose, who is one of the decent judges that you have, but it was before him. And I never forgot one thing that he said about Gallagher. Leo Gallagher was the lawyer. And he said, "You know, Ambrose and I became very good friends." So he said, "You know, Mr. Nessie, you made a very big mistake in having Gallagher as an honest guy. But you don't need an honest guy as a lawyer here. You need someone who knows how." He said, last year, I had a case of two longshoremen were brought before me for murder. And they had a guy by the name of Shipley from Long Beach, an Arab, by the way, a Baraban ancestry, who is the shrewdest guy you can. Now, I'm just as sure as I am that I'm talking to you, those guys are guilty. But you know what this Shipley said? "Ladies and gentlemen, look at my clients. Nature was so very niggardly with them, but look at their faces. They look guilty when they're innocent. Are you going to go ahead and add to the torture these poor guys have had to go through all their life? There's no real evidence. It's all circumstantial. It could happen to any of us that was circumstantial. They could tie us into something. Remember, it's only circumstantial, and although most of the evidence is circumstantial, this is very circumstantial. But the thing, main thing against them is their looks. Are they responsible for their looks? All their lives they've had to go through because nature did this to them. Are you going to add to their suffering and everything? Ladies and gentlemen, I ask of you for an act of mercy as well as justice in behalf of these unfortunately ill-featured people.
And they were quick.
They were feed.
Now, what happened in Webster's case then? You once mentioned something about this one who was involved in the case who was on the run, who came over.
Yes, he stayed at my house, and that was the silly thing that Maya Balin, who was in charge of all radical things in San Pedro, he is now a millionaire, he brought Claude Spellman over to my house one night, and it was the worst thing he could have done. I don't know how. He says, look, this guy is a longshoreman who's been accused of something. He has nowhere to go. Can he stay here? So, of course, it was always a haven for any of them. So he stayed there. And we said, now his name, I said, I could see the terror in the guy's, I said, his name, as far as I know, is Tom O'Connell. I had a friend who was a revolutionary in Berkeley, O'Connell. I don't want to know his name. The next morning, when I went to bring in the Los Angeles Morning News, there on the front page is his picture, his name, Claude Spellman, and that he's wanted for murder.
And he was one of the five?
Huh?
He was one of the five along with
yes, he was one of the five afterward. And he was so scared while he was at my house. He stayed 3 weeks in my house. And every time he comes to the window, look at that man standing over there. Is he watching me? He was absolutely terrorized, you know. So he said, you know, finally after the 3 weeks, he said he was leaving. He could no longer stand the torment, nor could we. And we took him 40 miles out of the city, wearing dark glasses. He wore dark glasses, and every time we just stopped at a traffic signal or anything, he was terrorized. I never saw anyone in such terror. And yet they were absolutely innocent. But they knew how easy it was to frame any of them. So, Grover Johnson was the lawyer. Grover Johnson was a very honest, very fine person. He had been in the Imperial Valley, and that's how he first got acquainted with the radical movement. And he really became dedicated to defending them.
Now, what exactly had happened? There had been a longshore strike?
It had been a kind of a strike. It was threatened. And, of course, the bosses there, everything. And they were freed at that, although even in spite of Leo Gallagher being just such a nice guy, he lost his temper, you see.
Well, who had been shot?
There was Dick Remster, Claude Smallman, there was three of them. One was the guy, we called him Captain. He had only one leg. And Francis knew them all very well, and Francis knew all of them intimately in Oakland and Berkeley. There were five of them.
And it happened in San Pedro here?
It happened in San Pedro here.
And who was it that had been shot?
One of the reactionary guys who was fighting the longshoremen. Yeah, he was shot. But they were pretty, you know, Dick Webster was related to the Websters. His father was a small-time professor in Massachusetts. His mother had been a trained nurse. His sister was a millionaire. And Dick Webster was the kind who was very compassionate. When he came to New York City and saw how poor people, how in the summer they stayed on their skyscrapers because it was so hot, and in the winter they never had enough heat, he was just so wrought up about it because his parents were not, his parents were liberals. And so he joined the movement. He joined the Communist Party because he was so angry to see that such things in the richest country in the world could happen.
Is that how Francis met him, was through the party?
Francis met him as when he was a longshoreman in San Francisco. She was the secretary for the Maritime Federation, and she met him then. And he was her, maybe her second or third husband, I don't remember, she had four of them.
And then they moved down to San Pedro?
Then they moved down to San Pedro, yes, they moved down then. You see what he had a kind of a disease where he perspired terribly, I forget the names, and he'd wasted away to a shadow, although he ate tremendously, but he never gained anything, you know. So Bernard got back to Bullock, but Bernard was just finishing as a student at Douglas. So he got one of the best doctors in the thing for nothing for him. And he put him on a kind of a diet, too, and everything, and told him that the worst thing for him was he finally committed suicide at the end. In San Francisco, he went to see, there was a girl who was interested in she was one of those playgirls, and she became very interested in him as a romantic figure. And he was on trial there, so she'd come every day to the jail to see him and bring him things and talk about things, you know, and everything, and fell in love with him. And here Francis had been the one who had instituted everything, but Francis didn't really care, but and everything. So Francis, so Judge Ambrose was very angry at her about it because he thought he liked Francis very much. So he told Francis, "You are just so kaput with him and everything." So Francis did get a divorce.
Now, was the trial up in San Francisco or here?
Here. Uh-huh. Here in Los Angeles.
How long did it last?
It lasted, I know, well over a month. And then they called me as a witness, too, because Smallman had been there. And they asked, they said, see, at that time, the guy who was the secretary of the Communist Party was nothing but a lumpen, son of a bitch, screw pigeon, really. His name was, look at Hall directly, remember?
Oh, it was of the Southern California secretary?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So when he was on the stand, he said they met in my house and what they discussed. I never met him. He was never in my house. So when they called me to the stand, I said, Judge Ambrose, I want to say, first of all, that man is the damnedest liar you ever heard. He never was in my house. I never met him. I never spoke to him even when I went up to the hall and everything. So he's a liar.
Now,
so
this was the secretary of the Communist Party?
Yes.
And he turned out to be a stool pigeon?
Yes.
Ah.
Those, you'll know his name and everything. And one of the people who knew him intimately was a man by the name of Joe Mandelak. And he was a close friend of mine, Joe Mandelak, and his wife. So Joe said that when he was in jail, he was a member of the Baker's Union. And then this guy came to him and said to him, look, I want your card. He said, why? He said, because you were told to pull in all the cards. He said, you're getting no card of mine. Yes. He says, you're getting no card of mine. And he reported him to the top guys in the party, and they said they must be just jealous of him. They wouldn't even listen, you know, and everything.
It sounds so, like what happened in Colorado, doesn't it?
Yes, very, very true. Very true. History repeats itself, unfortunately. So he never gave it to him, but he reported him, and he came over here, and he was a close friend of mine. And he afterwards, he had been, you know, he was a very inventive guy. He came into Los Angeles in an old jalopy with two children and no money and no job. So he went into the Union Depot and he said, and the person in charge then of the Travelers Agency was Vera, the head of the Communist Party in San Pedro, the Gulf Coastman. She was his wife, although she was not a member of the party, but she was in sympathy with it. So Joe went up, but Joe had a nerve that I never saw and I always admired. He went up and he said, look, we just came in. This is the United States, and we're you know, people calling him, and I have no place to go, and it's beginning to rain, and I want to know if you have any facilities. And Guru said, well, we have no facilities for anything like that. He said, then you will have to just sleep in the She said, you can't do that. He said, oh, you'd be surprised what you can do. This belongs to the people, doesn't it? And we have no place to go. We're going to sleep here. And he said to his wife, Florence, Florence, bring in the blankets and the whatever bedding we have. And she says, oh, my God, you know, you can't do that. He says, unless we have other we can do it, because my children are not going to be out in the car when it's raining without anything. So she says, well, before you do, please give me 1 hour, will you? He says, all right, I'll give you 1 hour and not 1 cent or more. She called up something. Before you know it, in less than an hour, in a half an hour, someone was down there. They had rented a room for them. They brought a basket of food for them, and they went there. And I said, Joe, nobody but you could do a thing like that. And this was the kind of a guy who goes and reports this man. And this man he had 7 children. He was not only a student pigeon, but he was a horrible, obscene man. And well, you know, they're all liars.
Well, how did he get himself in so tight in the party?
Well, see, he was living in a place not far from Joe Mandernick, and he got to know all of the longshoremen, and he was nice to them, and they participated in their strikes and everything. And he had a smattering that Marx's and everything. And they trusted him and everything. Mm-hmm. And all he did he was a steel pigeon.
Well, do you think that he was actually an agent in the beginning, or that
yes, he was an agent from the beginning. Oh. Yeah. And Joe said he was a lump of proletariat. And he had no, the only thing is he had no more loyalty to them than to us. He was in there just to whatever he could. He was making a living. He just had a hard time to keep a job. And he had 7 children.
Well, Bob, was the trial then basically an anti-labor trial?
Yes, it was an anti-labor trial. But this judge happened to be a very honest guy. I want to tell you something that happened with this judge. You know, Judge Ambrose, I said, you are really an honest judge. And I said, you know that many of your brothers are not. I said, did you ever hear the poem by James Russell Lowell's Freedom? He says, no, do you know it? I said, yes, I do. He said, will you say it for me? See, some of the commoners thought I was, you know, kowtowing to a judge, you know. But I thought, you talk to anyone, no use in talking to them. So you remember the poem.
Mm-hmm.
But he was so impressed with that poem, he just loved it. He said, oh, I am so grateful to you. Will you do me a very great favor? Will you type it out for me? I said, I'll be glad to. And you know that every judgment he made, he then leaned over backwards to get all the things to them. You see, there are some, mm-hmm. you know, when Carol Jean, my youngest daughter, was married, she was 17, we went over to Judge Ambrose, and he didn't take a cent for it. He said, put that in the kitty for whatever makes on the middle one. And he said, whenever you're in trouble, he said to me, you come to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Isn't that very nice?
Now, was he generally known as being more liberal, at least?
He was known as being more honest. Mm-hmm. He was very careful, because he said to me, you know, I have to have a job, too, and I have to do, but within the law,
mm-hmm.
I give every benefit of the law.
Oh.
And everything. I will not, and you couldn't buy him.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't just offer him anything, you know. He was really, and he was a very nice human being.
Hmm. Well, yeah. Barbara, in the trial itself, was the focus primarily on the murder charge, or did they invoke a lot of the ordinances against picketing and that sort of thing?
Oh, well, of course they brought in the Smith Act, the everything that, you know, that would bolster uh-huh. them up and everything. But nevertheless, they didn't have enough evidence to go on,
uh-huh.
so they did have to free them.
They brought out that they were all members of the Communist Party? And,
oh, yes, they accused them, although really and truly they were not all members of the Communist Party. Klaus Norman was not a member of the Communist Party. His Webster was. and a number of the others, like the one that they call Camp and everything, were not really members of the Communist Party, but they were all members of the Sailors Union and of the Bridges Union, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And Bridges at that time was under attack too, you know.
Well, this sounds like it must have been in the late 40s then, rather than the early
40s. Let me see, because Francis... No, it couldn't have been, because Susie was... Francis married Jim Malamud, and Susie was born in 43, and this was before then.
Oh,
so it might have been 39.
Oh.
But I thought it was in the 40s.
Oh, okay. I can check out when the
yes,
was.
Yes, yes.
But, so they did drag in the fact that they were all communist sympathizers.
Yes,
though.
Oh yes, that they brought out. And they used, of course, these laws that they had, the McCallum Act, everything else, you know, against them, you know.
So it really was very much a political trial.
Oh, it was, of course. Any of those trials were a political trial. The one that Dorothy was in 1951, I think it was, 52. That was one of the big trials, you know, when Sim Connolly, who had, you see, he joined the Communist Party because of his principle. Although he had been a choir boy in the Catholic Church, he hated Catholicism. He said Catholicism is fascism, you know. Oh, his daughter is dedicated to and married to my son-in-law's nephew. Also to a Jew.
All family.
Yes. And everything. But Slim... Now, Slim was an excellent newspaper man. He had been one of the top guys in the Herald, you know. And had he not stood by, they couldn't have done anything to him, you know. But he said, well, you have to have some principle and stand by what you really believe. He said, I think the Communists have done some stupid things, but I think I do believe in communism.
Well, Barbara, in fact, last time we started what we talked about, we ended by talking about the whole period of the arrest and your fears about Dorothy, that you knew the arrest was coming. But we didn't talk at all about the trial. We just talked about the whole idea of how you felt about the people who went under.
Well, the trial that took place with Dorothy, I had taken Ricky, at that time he was 7 years old, to San Cristobal. They had a kind of a thing there run by very, very liberal people. And I also took Elaine Rose Truner's daughter with me, you know, and Ricky, because Dorothy didn't want Ricky to be present when she was arrested. She thought it might be such a shock to him and would... Yes, very, very.
She knew that it was very close then.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, when she was arrested, you know, it was in a car and I was with her in the car.
You were with her when
yes, I was with her in the car.
You took Richard and left him in New Mexico then?
No, I stayed there the whole time, 3 weeks.
Oh, but how did you happen to be here then when she was arrested?
Well, she was arrested before, but you see, although she was arrested, there was nothing at home or anything at all, you know, that would have happened at the house, that the police came to the house. It was in a car. As we turned the corner, Slim and she were arrested.
Well, now you were in the car with them.
Yeah.
You had already taken Richard, or you hadn't taken him yet?
No. It was right after that we went.
Oh. And then you went and stayed for the...
I stayed there 3 weeks with him.
But then you were here during the trial itself.
Yes, well, the trial lasted for months.
Mm-hmm.
The trial lasted a long time.
Now, what I was very... Do you recall, in Al Richmond's book, I thought it was so interesting, he talked about the comrades who organized for them to bring them meals.
They had a committee. Oh, yes, there was a committee. Every day they brought a dinner to them, you know. Every day. for months.
How was it organized exactly?
Well, you see, especially some of the, most of them were Jewish women, you know, who, some of them from Beverly Hills in Hollywood. They were part of the American League Against War and Fascism. A great many of them were. They had this committee that had been down. And I know that here there was a little cafe here on 83rd Street run by Schindler's. And they were party people. They contributed meals, also sending meals to them, you know. People contributed them. And every day there was that committee that brought them food.
Now, were you at the trials throughout?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I went almost every day. You see, even Richie was here during the trial. He was back in 2 weeks. So they didn't allow Richie to go up in the jail to see his mother. But at the trial, he could be in the audience.
Oh, I see.
And, you know, one of the FBI prosecutors, I think I told you about that.
Oh, yeah, the sheriff who left. Who arranged the way for him to see her.
Yes, and yes.
Well, Barbara, so, during that period, were you then called on a lot, kind of to be the person on the outside who would be Dorothy's spokeswoman?
Well, I did errands for them. For instance, if they had messages to give to the People's World or anything like that, I did that, you know. And then I also call, you know, many people called me up to find out that I gave them the information they came, because the trial was heavily attended. Every seat was filled. And you know what was funny is that the prosecutor knew where everyone sat, but sometimes they made a mistake because they sometimes switched. So when someone said to one of the witnesses, they were all liars, do you know whether it was that was at that time? Oh, yes, real well. Will you point them out and find out someone who wasn't at home? And, oh, they were very crestfallen because we learned to switch seats around and not many. But many of them who came who had known nothing about it became very interested. Now, I remember a woman from Hollywood who sat next to me. She was in, from the Young Women's Christian Association, and she said, you know, I find out that there are more things going on than I learned in my association and this, and she asked questions about it, you know, and you'd be surprised how many really wanted to help.
Well, that was amazing, given the repression. Yes. Now, so in other words, you, because as Dorothy's mother, you had visiting privileges then.
Well, you see, because I was Dorothy's mother, the bail that had been set there in the beginning was $100,000, which is really so ridiculous. So we had to go before the head guys of the FBI there who were in charge of it. And one of them who really, I think I told you about him, that I can't remember his name, but he had that funny kind of a face like the cartoons are made of. And I had come late to one of the meetings, and he had been late. So he was running up the steps, and I was coming too. And I stopped him, you know. He wanted to get away from me. And I said, you know, you are a man of culture and education. Bim was one who was nothing but a swill. He was just a barrel of swill. I said, but you are. How can you do what they are? He said, what is it you object to? I said, now you know that these people are not guilty of anything you've charged. He says, I know the history of all of them. I know everything Dorothy did in the Imperial Valley. And I know that eventually they're going to have socialism here. I said, why do you tell me this? He said, do you know why? Because I take it that you have some sense, even if you're a communist. He said, if you told anybody that I had said this to you, what do you think I'd say? You'd say, now see how the communists lie? Would I tell this to the communists? He says, I told you I thought you had some sense. That's right. He says, you wouldn't do you one bit of good, and you couldn't do me any harm coming from you. Because, now, did you do it? And he was the one that when I introduced him to Ricky, And he said, I'm glad to know you. And Ricky said to me, is he a good guy? Is he on our side? Is he a friend? I said, oh, no, he's the prosecutor of the, and everything. He says, why didn't you tell me? I wouldn't have shaken hands with an enemy. So when he came out for a recess, I said, do you know what my grandson said about you? He asked me if you were a friend, and I said, oh, no, he's the enemy. He's the one. He says, why didn't you tell me? I wouldn't have shaken hands with him. He said, Mrs. Mister, that wasn't nice of you. Why did you call me an enemy? This is my job. Why did you tell Richard that I'm an enemy? Well, that surprised me so much that he'd be concerned so that he had something really decent about him. And he said, and you know, he became a judge because of the work he did. Uh-huh. And when he was a judge, he died 2 years after he was a judge. He was one of the most liberal judges on the... No.
Well, Barbara, given your penchant for always talking to everybody, did you have other experiences like that where you tried to talk to the FBI? And
yes, I tried to talk to the FBI. There were two young guys were in the FBI, and I stopped them, and I said, how can you... Look, you're young men. You ought to know something of the history of this country. How can you do what you're doing? So, do you know what both of them said to me? Look, we were out of work, and now we got a job, and we're getting paid. And don't you give me anything. I don't give a damn. I don't give a damn about anything at all except that we're getting paid to do this. We need the job.
Did them have any doubts or any... What? I guess why I'm bringing it up is the fact that I just found out that in the Foley Square trial of the 12 leaders in New York, Yedeland had a volume about the trial that was put out, that one of the key FBI witnesses was Fred Cook. Well, remember in the 60s, Fred Cook is the one who started to expose the
FBI. That's right.
And I wonder if in your experience locally on Dorsey's case you had any of those...
Yes, we had a newspaper man. The unfortunate thing was that he really was very, very progressive. But he drank, and he was so drunk most of the time. And his wife is a very wealthy woman. We became very good friends. And he was a friend of her, Esteem Connolly. But he drank, so he was one of the main writers, one of the feature writers on the Los Angeles, too bad that it sold. I thought that was a much better paper than the Los Angeles Times.
Oh, the Mirror?
Not the Mirror. The Mirror is owned by the Times. The Los Angeles News.
Oh.
Morning News. It was a man. Who was the editor of it? He sold out, and he was a very weak liberal.
They did a better job of covering the trial than they were.
Yes, they did. They had many very, very liberal guys. On their staff. They're very liberal.
Well, Barbara, tell me, during the trial, were you, this is when I imagine you found out about many people who were stool pigeons who came to testify. Were you surprised by most of what happened, or had you...
Yes, I was surprised about some of them, because I couldn't see how they could do it. I just couldn't understand. Someone told me, you know, Barbara, you still have ideals. Well, I said, don't you? He said, well, but at least I let it conform to what's happening here and everything. I was sometimes surprised, but then sometimes not. But one thing I'll tell you, there was a guy by the name, I think his name was Lancaster. He had been a member of the Communist Party. He was a stool pigeon, a member of the FBI all the time. And he came to my house. And Dorothy had let me, did I tell you about that? Dorothy had let me have a biography of the English Communist Party head. And he had been here, and he told me how his, he came from Virginia. He was divorced and had a little girl 6 years old. And we became very friendly. And I said to one of our comrades, I said, who recruited him? And she said, Frank Spector. I said, Frank Spector? Well, that had it all up. And she said, why are you... I said, I'll tell you why I'm suspicious of him, and I may be all wrong, that no matter what we tell him to do, go down and distribute leaflets down at Pershing Square. Nobody, most of them would be afraid to. And he's got a little 6-year-old girl. He goes. And I'm just inclined to be suspicious. I don't know why, but I am. So one time, Dorothy tells me that she wants the book back. And I look high and low. I can't find it. So then I ask the Schimberg, who was there helping prepare meals for them, Harry, did you take it? He was here that time. He says, no, I didn't. You offered it to me to read, and I said, I had no time for it. And I said, but I never thought of, I knew Lancaster had been there, but I never dreamt of that, you know. And we had gone to meet in the park in Florence at Englewood Park, and he was driving us. No longer time about that. So when he was testifying, Dorothy said, and he testified that he had come to my house.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing, each time they testified against me, they never said that I used violent language, that I spoke of revolution, that all I spoke about was peace, that we should have a world of peace. It's strange, even stupid against me. I don't remember.
Why were they testifying against you?
Because they used to meet at my house, you know. We had so many of the meetings. I thought my home was practically headquarters always, wherever we lived.
How did they then pull it into Dorothy's case?
In Dorothy's case, it was...
Why?
In Dorothy's case, they only told me to testify because at that time, I don't think that when Dorothy and Slim were that I was involved in that. I can't remember that. Except the one that when the... a former secretary of the party who was shown as the agent.
In other words, when they testified against you, it was primarily to cast aspersions on your character, is that it?
Only to show that my home was the headquarters for revolution. And really, and truly, most of it was a lie.
Now,
but
was this during the Smith Act, during Dorothy Smith Act trial? Was that?
Yes. Uh-huh. So, what was I talking
about? We were talking about this Lancaster.
Oh, yes, Lancaster. So when Lancaster testified that he had been in my house and everything, So Dorothy said to me, Mama, wasn't Lancaster in your house when that book about the... I said, yes, he was. She said, he has your book. And, you know, then after he got the... He avoided my eyes. And after he got through, there was a recess. When we were coming out, I was there, and I said, you goddamn thief, you give back my book. You're not only a stupid, but you're a thief. And, you know, he ran for me and raced down to go to, wouldn't even take the elevator, but raced down on the, near the edge of the devil were after him.
Well, and in that case, you were someone that you weren't suspicious of. And this is the beginning of a very repressive era. When you would bring up your suspicion to the others, how was it then dealt with? Was there any checking out more of a person?
I really don't think they did. And then especially when... See, this guy had been a neighbor of Frank Spector's. Frank Spector had even taught him... Oh, no. Yes, Frank Spector had recommended him. But Larry... Oh, another guy who lived near him, who was a mathematician. He had taught him those things, you know, in his job, that the man got 3 times as much pay afterwards. I said, Larry, weren't you ever suspicious of him? How could I be suspicious of a man that Frank Spector put up for, you know?
It seems to me that this whole...
They recruited many, you know. Just recruiting was a feather in their cap. See, one of the people that I knew, teachers, the Clavies, both of them high school teachers, he was a principal, and I had known him. I had met him as a speaker at one, some of the forums. So they said, look, because the Clavies, and they knew, they were friends of Musk, and they belonged to the Shelley Club, you know, artists, you know, and they knew an awful lot of people that we didn't, but whom they could say, and they were very wonderful people. So I heard him speak at Emmanuel Arch, and I was so impressed with him that I said to the woman sitting next to me, "I'm so glad I came. He's a wonderful speaker." She said, "Do you like him?" I said, "Don't you?" She said, "Well, I should. He's my husband." And then she told me, and from that time,